So Brandon, the best place to begin is with your personal origin story and background. What were you doing prior to BWCP? And then we'll start to talk about how that experience led to the founding of the firm.
We can take it all the way back. I got into investing in a strange way. I'm from Kansas City, middle-class background. My parents made me have jobs, and the only one I could stomach at the time was mowing yards. And I started a business when I was probably 14. It turned into a passion for investing. And the reason that was is I noticed early on when I was able to drive, you should drive to the nicest areas you can find. They had the best profit margins on mowing. And I got to know some of my clients that I was mowing yards for. And they were young guys that were obviously doing very well. And I asked them a couple times what they did. And they told me they worked for American Century. And I didn't know what American Century was. I'd never heard of it. They put me onto some books. And it was simple. This was 94, 95. It was Peter Lynch, One Up on Wall Street. They said, find things you're passionate about, what products people are passionate about, and do that and make it your own. And that's what we do. We figure out how the world works. So I started investing in 1996. I opened these accounts. And what I saw then was phones. Phones were starting. You know, it was the beginning of the cell phone era. And so the first three stocks I bought, which really kind of ingrained a passion for investing, were things that were involved with cell phones. And so I go to college and I'm basically wondering if I ever am going to have a job. These are 10 bagger type stocks at the time, and it was the late 90s. And I really wanted to figure out how to turn this into a real career, not just the day trading stuff. And I was lucky enough in college to have a great financial professor. My finance professor helped me get a job with Goldman Sachs. So I went and spent a couple of years in New York doing investment banking. And I was really fortunate. My first job came with a firm called Highside Capital. And Highside, this is why BWCP's roots are in Dallas now. Highside was a Tiger Cub spinoff. I guess it spun out of Maverick, so it was a Tiger Grand Cub. I spent 8 years there doing technology, media, and telecom. Phenomenal firm. We were a few billion dollars. I got an opportunity. I was actually kind of thinking of forming this exact firm back in 2012. But Citadel came along, and Citadel was expanding into Dallas under the name Surveyor Capital, and they hired me, and I ran a portfolio for Citadel for 6 years, and it was a wonderful thing. And I tell you, what Citadel does so well is risk management and portfolio construction. What Tiger does so well is how do you find great ideas and uncover things that people aren't really thinking about and use time as your advantage. What I wanted to do, and this is what BWCP is kind of a bringing together of those two things. How do you use great fundamental stock picking, but understand that the world's different? When I started in 2004, 70% of the dollars traded were done so every day by fundamental managers. When you fast forward that to today, it's kind of the opposite, the inverse. And today, only 30 or 40% of the dollars are traded by fundamental managers. And so you need to be aware of what's going on. And so we use some risk tools, some of the factor awareness, some of the things that were from Citadel, but really just doing it around that framework of the Tiger Cub style of stock picking.
I love the fusing of those two disciplines of the rigorous portfolio construction quantitative that Citadel obviously is famous for with the deeper fundamental insight on businesses, which is a great bridge into the key things that you found setting up a new investment firm. There's a lot you need to do. It's a lot of effort. I've seen it done. I've done it myself. I know that it's difficult. And I think companies and research is one aspect that gets talked about less. Like most of the focus on legal and systems and team and all this kind of stuff. How was Canalyst a part of that early setup? What did the company models allow for relative to your prior experience that let BWCP get up and going faster, and sort of how were they used in the early days?
So let's paint a picture. You're running a $2+ billion hedge fund inside of Citadel. You have a team of six. You don't even know what back office means because every single thing is taken care of. And you have a lot of resources. And you have a lot of young analysts that need to spend a lot of time doing the Citadel way or whatever that is. Roll that forward. I have a couple analysts, myself, small back office, friends and family capital, and my money, basically our internal capital. And we've got to figure out how do we divvy up resources. Because right now, there's two things that are our most limited thing, time and money. And we have to find across the board, where can we use our analysts' time to do the things that are most impactful to the research process? And where can we outsource with great partners to leverage both that time and money? And that's where Canlis came in. And we used some of our friends. We asked them about best, you know, practices, how they utilize their limited resources up front. And Canlis came up time and time again. So what Canlis does for us, think about the amount of time that it takes to set up a model, to build a proper model, to update that model each quarter. We probably, with the number of stocks that we look at, we're saving 1.5 to 2 analysts a year. It sounds like a huge number, but that's probably only looking at, you know, maybe 100 to 200 companies. But to do that right, that's probably what it would take from a manpower point of view. Now, if you think about the research process, what is it about the model that's so important? Models are the output of a lot of inputs. And the value add that we need to spend our time with our team on is, what are the inputs? What do the numbers mean? It's not necessarily the building blocks of the nuts and bolts of the model, but it's what it really comes down to is, what are your assumptions? How good are your assumptions? And what do your assumptions mean? So whether or not you're a super long-term investor and you're going to make a decision once every 10 years, you still need to know, then what are the cash flows over those 10 years? If you're a super short-term investor, where you want to know everything about every margin, about every top line item, about every revenue trigger, you obviously need to make those assumptions somewhere and put them in models. So it's a basic building block, and it's the foundation of everything that we do, but it's not something that we want to spend all of our time doing the things that other people can do, so we can then turn around and use our time more valuably. And that has been a huge, huge help in how we allocate our resources.
How do you think about the uniqueness of company models that Canlis provides sector to sector? So you mentioned TMT being a focus. I think gap accounting is great, but it also isn't perfect as a way to interpret or measure or investigate how a specific company works. Say a little bit about like company specific metrics, KPIs, you know, things that matter for one business that might not matter for another, and how that factors into modeling.
So that's the other important part. I've used services in the past that give you sort of a starting place. There's two problems with those usually. One, they don't have hardly anything above sales. And to us, usually in the TMT space in particular, the top line is one of the more important variables. Margins have less controversy, but are obviously important, and then which brings us to free cash flow. So when you're using a generic service, sometimes you can get the basic building blocks of what's reported in maybe a Q with no context above for what's maybe reported on conference calls. Canlis adds that extra layer, which is important. But the most important part of it is the models live with us. So everything that we change or that we adapt to the things that we need, even if it's not already preloaded, we can add that and the model just simply updates. I used to have to send models away. And when they come back, they're stripped. Anything that I've added, any sales that I've done, anything has been a problem. Now the models sit here with us. And the reason it's important is because those models lead to our investment templates, our investment spreadsheets. Those investment spreadsheets are the things in which we pitch our stocks off of in our internal meetings, which then flow into our rankings. Our rankings are what create discussions about what in the world's going on. So you put a number into a model with Canlis, and it stays on my system and goes all the way through to price target changes. I do it with somewhere else and it has to go send off. The links break, it comes back, and all the work that we've done updating is gone. So how do we focus our attention on what is the most valuable stuff that we can do with the least amount of friction? And that's the important part. When you're using the Canlis system, there's no friction. And it allows us to maintain our process and almost like we just added a team member.
Where do you see the most opportunity today in the coverage universe that you care about? And what's unique about how those businesses look in terms of their financial statements and the levers that you think are important to underwrite and understand as an investor?
I'll take that a slightly different way, but I'll get back to the original question. The thing that's most interesting to us, and this is kind of reshaped versus when we started, again, we started really small and have been fortunate enough to grow to a few hundred million, but what has changed in the last 12 to 18 months is the number of companies that have come public, whether that's IPOs, direct listings, all of these types of things are a big tax on the sell side, and they don't have enough time and energy to cover these things. And so if you think about, if your goal is to find something that is less well-known, undiscovered, something that has massive amounts of innovation, And your variant perspective could be simply knowing more about that company and actually being able to model it on a timely basis. That's where you have to have these types of partners. I would say the world from 2 years ago has changed dramatically in the sense that there are so many more companies. The sell side has not gotten bigger. If anything, it's getting smaller. The resources that they have to be able to help managers is not good, but it has gone down somewhat. So what I think is going to happen, if you think about active management and you think about the number of ideas, we'll probably shift more of our capital into small and mid caps over time, where we have a balance between small, medium, large. I didn't think that was something that was going to happen. You know, 2-3 years ago, people would say, you know, the number of companies are just disappearing. What is the role of active management? You can buy a few indexes. I think given the valuation, given that the stock market just continues to grind higher, some of the best places to go out and look are some of these more undiscovered things that are newer, both on the long and the short side. There's a lot of stuff that came to the market that has no real meaning and no real value. So that, I would say, has been a real big change in the number of types of companies that we're going to have to use for financial modeling. And I will tell you, when you're looking at things that have limited history, that's where a place like Canalys can come in. They'll be able to scrape that, they'll be able to go back, find historical stuff. And really what we're trying to do to sift through all of these, we have to get some baseline level of knowledge. And you can't do that building out your own models. It would simply be prohibitive.
In closing, thinking about other emerging managers, new managers that are hanging up their own shingle and setting up shop, what other key lessons did you learn about that process relative to your expectations? What was harder? What was easier? What did you have to do that you didn't even think about?
There's a lot of lessons. Look, I will say a few things. One, starting a fund can be a very humbling experience. I had a manager, an allocator, tell me early on, if I could tell all new managers one thing, it would be that the world doesn't need another hedge fund. What makes you different and why do you need to exist? And that's a tough pill to swallow when you're out on the road marketing. I think people really wanted Citadel. So when we left, they loved Citadel and they wanted us to replicate Citadel. And I will tell you, some people have been able to do it, but replicating Citadel is a very tall thing. So the advice I would give is find what you want to do. And what we wanted to do was slightly different. And if the thing that what you want to do is slightly different, in our case, it was a bringing together of the Tiger Cub and the high side model with the Citadel model, be prepared to take a few steps on your own before somebody will underwrite you. And I don't think that it's a negative thing. I think we all get convinced that one or two people, raising $5 billion day one means that the fundraising environment is very good. And I think we all have survivorship bias towards all of the people we look up to, whether it be Ken Griffin or Steve Mandel or all these people who have come before us. Those funds started really, really small and they proved it. And they worked themselves out for a few years. And I think that's probably the biggest lesson. The other one is getting off to a great start. You can never underestimate the power that that has. And that was something that, you know, we were very fortunate to be able to do. And then the last thing I would say, and I've had a lot of mentors over the past, and they've always said, well, if you want to do something, you're going to have to find something that you love to do. You can't do something that you don't love to do. And I used to think that that was just something that people said that were super successful. And that was a nice tagline, but investing is a hard business. And what those allocators mean when they don't think everybody needs to be a hedge fund manager, they mean that. And so if you don't, investing can have its ups and downs. And if you don't love what you do on a day-to-day basis and love building something, you know, from the ground up, you're really going to have trouble. And I think don't underestimate the amount of time it's going to take you to build it. Don't underestimate the amount of money that it's going to cost to build, and find the most talented people you can possibly find. I think sometimes new managers fall into a trap of not wanting to hire people they think are a lot smarter than they are. I tell everybody that we hire, I hope that I'm the dumbest person in the room. I want the smartest people around because that's how we'll become more successful.
Well, Brandon, I love your story. Love the fusing of styles, and also love the fact that the leverage point for Canalys existed in the early days that it let you do more faster. And I think you've made great points about sort of why repetitive processes that are nonetheless important and detail-oriented matter a lot, but the 1.5 to 2 analysts sort of stuck per couple hundred companies per year, that's a real thing. So I think we've done a great job of overviewing your story and also the ways in which it intersects with the Cantalus product. Really appreciate your time and wish you the best of luck in your brand new firm.
Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.